Good afternoon. My name is Kate Cruikshank, and I'm the political papers archivist at Indiana University Bloomington. This is session 701, The Art of Archival Judgment, Applying More Product, Less Process, MPLP. When Mark Green and Dennis Meisner published their article on More Product, Less Process in the winter 2005 issue of American Archivist, they were hoping to create a stir, and they certainly succeeded. In the 5.5 years since its publication, sessions on MPLP by the authors and others have adorned professional meetings all over the country and appeared in the pages of many archival publications. Archivists with overwhelming backlogs have embraced MPLP as a way to dig themselves out and provide access to hidden collections. Archivists receiving huge new collections have seen it as a way to avoid creating those kinds of backlogs. At the same time, concerns have been raised about the possible dangers of exposing classified, sensitive, or private information when folders are not carefully reviewed. Some have worried that if processing is at such a general level that it is not known what is in the folders, the removal of documents from them would go undetected. Heeding Green and Meisner's emphasis on the wise use of resources, others have suggested that the time saved in processing may only result in the expenditure of more time by reference archivists in helping patrons access collections, an issue explored in 601 this morning. Thus, Green and Meisner have stimulated many rich discussions across a wide range of issues. This session, however, is focused not on a debate about MPLP, but on the great variety in its applications. Our session is based on two basic assumptions that I believe Mark Green and Dennis Meisner share, and I suspect most of the rest of us. First, there is no single approach to processing that is optimum for all collections or even all series within collections. I say this with emphasis to counter the fears that I've heard expressed from some experienced archivists that new archivists may be entering the field thinking that MPLP is the only approach to use. So hear us, it is not the only approach to use. Second assumption is that it is archival judgment that is at the core of our professional practice and our professional worth. Judgment as to what to accept, judgment as to what is worth keeping, judgment as to how to make it accessible. We offer to you today examples of how that judgment is exercised in the application of MPLP, or basic processing, or minimal processing, and to a wide variety of situations, when it seems appropriate and why, when not, and why not. In the course of our session, we hope you will gain insights as to how to think about your own collections and how to analyze them for the applicability of minimal processing as a tool. Are you getting feedback? Is this coming through okay? Okay, because I'm getting a little thing here, and I thought, oh my gosh, if you're getting that, it's going to be really annoying. Okay, let me introduce our presenters today. I'll introduce them in order, going down the table in the order in which they will speak. Barbara Austin, the Florence M. Crowfoot Archivist at the Connecticut Historical Society. Sitting next to her, Jennifer Wright, Assistant Archivist and Archives and Information Management Team Leader at the Smithsonian Institution Archives. Next to her, Maya Anderson, who is Processing Archivist at the Special Collections Research Center of the University of Chicago. And on the far end, Elizabeth Cassidy West, University Archivist at the University of South Carolina. Each of our presenters is aiming to speak for 12 minutes, and we'll work to hold ourselves to that, so there'll be plenty of time for discussion. And now, Barbara, please start us on exploring the art of archival judgment, applying more product, less process.
The Connecticut Historical Society, where I work, was founded in 1825, and we've been collecting ever since. I arrived at the Historical Society 6 years ago and found the manuscript collections in a less than ideal state, to put it mildly. We have at least 5,000 cubic feet of manuscript material, and maybe 18% of that had been cataloged in our online catalog. The bulk of the collection had absolutely no catalog record at all, and some was still in the card catalog. So our poor researchers were dealing with a catalog, an online catalog, a card catalog, and the archivist to be able to find anything. So for some strange reason, I decided to write a grant to NHPRC for a basic processing. And it's actually not processing. What we're doing is cataloging our backlog. We set a goal of 900 collections over the course of 2 years, and there were two of us working on it. In order to do that, and we thought in order to convince NHPRC that we could do what we were going to do, we also made the decision to use minimal processing, regardless of the age of the collection or the condition. And I will tell you, it is the hardest decision and the hardest application I have ever had to do. We were dealing with 18th and in some cases 17th century documents, and I wanted to take care of each of these lovely pieces of paper individually. But in order to meet that goal of our cataloging, we couldn't do that. We couldn't refolder, we couldn't rebox, we couldn't take out the staples, we didn't photocopy newspaper, we left the photographs in the collection, and we left all sorts of realia, three-dimensional objects, in the collections. But, to cover myself, we also had an inventory. One of the first things I did when I got to the Historical Society was inventory absolutely everything that was in the building that was a manuscript. And then I went through all of the accession records, which go back to 1825, and wrote down all of the accessions that we're supposed to have in the collection, and then made this huge access database that has not only the name, the creator, the accession number if we have it, its location, whether or not the collection is processed, and then for the grant, we added such things as highly valuable, monetarily valuable collections like George Washington's signature, whether there was something that needed conservation, and specifically whether there was anything that was going to need more detailed processing at a later date. And part of that was also due to NHPRC now having that two-tiered grant process where you get the basic processing grant first, and then you can go back to them, we hope, for money to do a more detailed processing. And we've got several collections that we will need to do much more detailed work on, and we hope to get that money from NHPRC. As I said, this is one of the hardest decisions I ever had to make. I do use it now with incoming collections much more than I used to. And we had a collection come in recently that was in somebody's attic and or basement and or I don't think it makes any difference because the thing was covered with bird droppings and mouse droppings and all sorts of stuff. But that was very quickly reboxed and put into storage with very, very minimal description. But now it's not in the garage anymore, and it's accessible to people who want to use it. I'd like to report that our 900 collection goal that we set for NHPRC has been met and then some. We have two more weeks to go, and when I left to come here, we had 1,934 collections that were cataloged. Thank you.
Morning. The Smithsonian Institution Archives collects and maintains the official records of the Smithsonian, as well as the papers of associated individuals and organizations. Our collection of permanent records consists of almost 35,000 cubic feet, most of which is located in off-site commercial storage, and we often receive over 1,000 cubic feet of new accessions in a single year. MPLP is a term that we never use within our archives, unless we're specifically referring to the Green-Meisner article. That's because MPLP was something that was just a new term for something we were already doing. By 1997, we were beginning to realize that we would never be able to fully process everything that we were accessioning. Somewhat haphazardly, we began creating guidance for housing and descriptive levels that were good enough. With this, we also began placing more emphasis on processing at the time of accession. Now, this was just a step up from the basic inventories that were generally being created at the time of accession anyway. We're now working, at that time, we were working with the understanding that collections may or may not be fully processed in the future and should therefore be processed at an adequate level at the time of accession. At the time, it was assumed that many collections would still eventually be fully processed, and good enough was still a shifting target. Our concept and policies, as well as our procedures for minimal processing, are constantly being refined, even now, over a dozen years later. And we're making those changes based upon our experience and the changes in the environment in which we work. For instance, we no longer have a staff dedicated to processing collections. More detailed levels of processing are generally only performed by contractors, or when there's a major event, or when extensive preservation is needed, and to prevent loss, and we receive a grant to do so. At the same time, the volume of records being accessioned into the archives is increasing, as more Smithsonian offices are beginning to realize that we exist, and they're taking advantage of our services. We now have the same number of staff accessioning more institutional records, while also providing what will most likely be the only processing these records will ever receive. For us, minimal processing is no longer an option, it's the norm. We do not decide to do minimal processing. That decision has already been made. Minimal processing is our base. The only decision we make is when a higher level of processing is necessary. So what is minimal processing within our archives? The simplest explanation is based upon the fact that the vast majority of our collections are maintained in off-site commercial storage. So the collection must be made safe to travel and described well enough to allow a researcher to identify individual boxes of interest. More specifically, all materials must be in meaningfully labeled folders, in acid-free boxes, and described at both the collection and the folder level. We also remove large attachments, paper clips and larger. We insert spacers and neaten up the materials. Procedures for audiovisual materials and electronic records differ based on the media, but we're still trying to reach that good enough level. The archivist accessioning the collection has the freedom to make judgment calls about what level of processing or what additional processing measures they decide to take. If the folders are worn or particularly acidic, the archivist may opt to replace them. If the collection is mostly arranged, the archivist may opt to finish the arrangement. If the collection is small and unfoldered, the archivist may decide to go ahead and do an item-level description. The archivists are not required to consult with the supervisors or anyone on staff about those decisions. We do encourage them to discuss anything too extensive. But they're discouraged from turning every accession into a full processing job because their performance plans require that they complete 60% of their accessions within 1 month of their receipt in the archives, and that includes the processing. Additionally, we track several types of information in our collections management system that help us identify collections that truly do need a higher level of processing than what can be reasonably given at the time of accession. Using numeric and alphabetic codes, or values, we note the level of description, the adequacy of the housing, the extent of existing damage to the records, the potential of future deterioration of the records, and the perceived value of the collections. And then there we have a matrix, which I have a very cursory understanding of, but it's all done within the computer, so we don't have to worry about it. But this matrix then assigns every collection a value that tells us what the priority is for future processing or additional processing. These collections may include collections that we do further levels of processing on may include materials with extensive damage, unusual materials for which we don't have specialized housing at the time, or large quantities of loose, unidentified materials that require an extensive amount of research to attempt to create folders and describe. From 2005 to 2009, the archives moved out of both its on-site and off-site storage facilities, and prepared most of our collections to be sent to our off-site commercial storage. We decided to apply minimal processing on all of the collections that would be moving. And the rules were similar to what we were doing for new accessions. We very quickly discovered that a lot of the collections that had been fully processed didn't even actually meet the levels of minimal processing that we were requiring at this point in time. So there was a lot of work to do. Processing work was performed by almost every staff member, as well as all sorts of interns and volunteers. We had reference archivists, historians, conservators, pretty much everyone in our office working on collections at some point in time. And they were all managed by the five of us who did the minimal processing for new accessions. For the first time, a set of instructions and guidelines for minimally processing collections was actually written. Prior to that, it had all been sort of word of mouth and general practice, but never anything that was concretely written down. Over the course of those 5 years, staff and interns minimally processed 10,910 cubic feet of records in 10,569 hours, which is an average of about 58 minutes per cubic foot. Today, 88.5% of our collections are processed at a level we deem satisfactory, and 83.5% of those collections have online finding aids with both a collection level and folder level description. Some of them actually even have item level description. We have a total of 3,600 finding aids online. And since 2000, which was when we really began doing the minimal processing for the new accessions, our average number of reference inquiries has risen from about 2,500 per year to approximately 6,700 per year. So the keys to successfully implementing minimal processing within our archives broken down to about five different issues that were really in our favor. First, although we do collect personal papers and the records of professional societies, the majority of our collection is institutional records, and they tend to be more straightforward than personal papers. Staff and researchers tend to know what to expect within those records and what not to expect within those records. It doesn't mean there are never surprises. There are always surprises. There are just fewer of them than in personal papers generally. The benefit of a more detailed finding aid in these cases doesn't really justify the amount of work that we would need to do to create it. Second, minimal processing began with the archivist responsible for accessioning collections, as opposed to the processing archivists. And the level of work required for the minimal processing was closer to what the accessioning archivists were doing anyway, and therefore it was less of a strange process. And once the processing archivists, which, like I said, we no longer actually have, but once they saw what we were doing, or they were more likely to buy into what we were doing and to the lower levels of processing. Three, the archivists are given the freedom to make decisions about levels of processing as long as they meet the minimum levels. This helps with morale. They're less likely to feel as if they're performing a disservice to the researchers, but their performance plans ensure that they don't go too far towards fully processing all of the collections. And also using minimal processing to decrease the backlog really helps with morale as well. Four, most of our finding aids are online and searchable via Google as well as several Smithsonian-based search engines. This allows researchers to search across all of our finding aids and identify related materials that are physically and intellectually separated. Although this isn't a true substitute for a more traditionally arranged collection and a more traditional finding aid, it's at least adequate for most researchers. Finally, we do not decide to implement minimal processing. We decide when to go beyond minimal processing. Changing the question that is asked can change the culture of your institution. Initially, there may be staff who have trouble adjusting to doing a lower level of processing, and there'll be some who do too little, as well as some who do too much. But as long as it's the expectation rather than the exception, the staff will eventually come around and be comfortable with what's expected of them.
So in December 2006, the University of Chicago Special Collections Research Center, which I'm going to call SCRC the rest of my talk, began an initiative to systematically reduce our unprocessed backlog of archives and manuscripts through the application of flexible processing standards. And this initiative was developed in response to a combination of pressures, and the most compelling of these was a very intense and growing research demand for university administrative records and 20th century manuscript collections. So around 2003, the Association of Research Libraries Task Force on Special Collections was also beginning to outline the concept of hidden collections. And this was really an early call for us to develop what would become a library-wide commitment to exposing unprocessed and underprocessed collections across the University of Chicago Library. A couple years later, as the MPLP discourse arose, this really helped us in Special Collections show that there was widespread support and interest for the type of processing model that we were proposing, that we weren't sort of going out on a limb. It wasn't a wild, rash experiment. And all of these factors highlighted how time-sensitive and mission-critical the state of our backlog was. And administrators responded to that by supporting the hiring of one archivist, who is me, and two graduate student processing assistants. So we had a long tradition of flexible processing standards in SCRC, like I know a lot of other institutions do. But we hadn't really assessed or formalized that tradition until this initiative began to take shape. Rather than adopting radically new processing procedures, we developed a tiered processing model that was based on our existing strengths and current practices that had worked for us. And the most important of these were our comprehensive accessioning procedures. Like at the Smithsonian, our accessioning is essentially a very lightest possible form of processing. We don't have a backlog of unaccessioned collections. We have a long-standing practice of employing graduate students as processing assistants, and this is something that we've been doing, as far as I can tell, since at least the 70s. And we also have a commitment to EAD finding aids as the primary access tool for our collections. So as the unofficial hidden collections archivist, I customize our approach to every collection. I determine the minimum level of processing for each collection that's going to balance research access, the preservation and security of the collection, and the expectations of donors and administrators. And my judgment is also very much informed by the state of our budget and the capabilities of the library's research environment. But whatever approach we take to processing, whether it's most basic or most detailed, we consider a collection fully processed if it has an EAD finding aid, a MARC record, it's physically organized so that the collection can be identified and paged as needed, and it's rehoused in archival containers. So when we began this project, the number one highest processing priority for us was the records of the Office of the President of the University of Chicago. And the rest of my talk is going to focus on this as a case study. So the collection consists of over 1,400 linear feet of subject files, budgets, and faculty appointment files. And these have been accrued over more than 30 years. And the records document the development of the university since around 1890, and they contain essential documents on the university's role in education and research, as well as material that our researchers now use to study urban planning, national and international affairs, and the economic and social development of the city of Chicago. So although most of this collection was unprocessed, it was nonetheless already one of our most popular collections in special collections, and it attracted university faculty and staff, graduate and undergraduate students, and visiting researchers who came from as far away as Europe and Asia. Its status as administrative records of a private university made it a most unlikely candidate for grant funding. So, support of our tiered processing initiative finally offered us the chance to meet the steady and even growing demand for access to this collection. Access to these records is governed by a formal agreement between the library and university administration. And the university imposes specific restrictions on access to certain types of administrative records. So, for example, after one president's term ends, all budget and appointment files are restricted for the following 50 years. However, complicating this further was that in the absence of any records management policy at our university, the files had always been transferred to the archives in a chronological mix. They're not separated by university or by presidential administration when we get them. It's more like the staff fill up a filing cabinet and then they call us so they can make room. So university policy essentially obligated us to organize all 1,400 linear feet by presidential administration so that we could identify and separate restricted material. Of course, this is also a nice way to organize your records to make it accessible for researchers. So it was my responsibility to develop a workflow that would facilitate speedy processing, support our transparent access policy, and comply with university regulations. The key to this project really ended up being the division of labor between myself and two graduate students who worked for me as processing assistants. I designed the workflow so that my time would be focused on tasks that required an archivist's judgments about access based on interpretation of administrative policy. So I surveyed the collection and started sorting files into series by presidential administration. In the process, I identified record series that were not subject to any restriction. They were free and clear. And I assigned these as student projects. I then identified record series that would be entirely restricted without seeking permission and getting permission from university administration. These record series are closed to research for the time being. So those also required no further deliberation on my part and could also be assigned to students. So most of my time on this project was actually taken up with the remaining record series, and those were the ones that contained a mix of restricted and open materials, and those required folder and sometimes item level review to determine what could be open to research and what we were still obligated to restrict. Once I had segregated restricted materials from the majority of files that could be open to research, I could then delegate the remaining work of arrangement and description to students. So through this process, record series that are accessible to researchers were processed within one 12-month period, and we maintained a processing rate that I estimate was about 1.2 linear feet per hour. And that includes the creation of EAD finding aids and MARC records. The remainder of the records consist mainly of files from the late 1970s and onward, and these are still heavily restricted. For these records, we invested time only in sorting the files and creating a basic inventory so that in the event that a researcher does receive permission from university administration to consult the records, we have a way for them to have a basic level of access. I've also staged these collections so that as restriction periods expire and new material is received, we can easily take processing to the next step. The records of the Office of the President are now used in special collections almost every day. The project serves as a model for other administrative records processing projects of this type in a CRC. Our success with this project helped support the expansion of what began as a 3-year project into an extended hidden collections initiative that is now almost 5 years old. And tiered processing is now an integral part of SCRC's spectrum of access initiatives that have transformed researchers' experience with our collections. Thanks.
Yeah. The University of South Carolina Archives was established in 1976 and focuses on the official records of the university. We do not take faculty materials and things like that. Many of those collections were already placed in the manuscripts division of the South Carolina Library, of which we are a unit, and so the decision was made not to start splitting up collections that way. As a public institution, we are subject to the South Carolina Public Records Act, and we do have retention schedules that govern what materials would be transferred to the archives and what can be destroyed. We have been without a full-time records manager for 18 years, however, and so I cover that as well. Sometimes it's hit or miss. I do have several offices that are my very, very good clients, so to speak. We look at the processing in two stages, and because we are dealing with institutional records, it's easier to apply elements of MPLP, although we also were doing much of this before we had ever heard of MPLP when I started in 1995 with the archives. We actually apply some processing to when we acquire the materials, and that's when we do our initial or minimal processing for those items. Once a collection is transferred to the archives, we will receive it with a folder list, an inventory from the department. The department is supposed to maintain that and transfer it with the materials. They're generally pretty accurate now. They used to be wildly inaccurate with some of the collections that I inherited when I joined the archives. And we will check against those. We have certain series, certain files that we look for that we automatically remove and destroy based on those retention schedules. Our primary collection of interest is the records of the presidents as well. Although ours are open 10 years after we receive the records. And sometimes they don't like that, but I just refer back to a past scandal involving a former president, in which case all of the records were thrown open to the media from FOIA requests, and it's a little hard to put the cat back in the bag after all of that's been opened up. So 10 years, or if we have a president that serves longer than 10 years, we will wait to open his materials fully until after he's gone. At this point, with the initial processing, after we take the folders out, we will look at certain series that we know typically have personal or student or private information in there and check those. We will also rebox if necessary. That doesn't happen very often anymore because we do provide the archival boxes to the offices every year, and they will arrive in archival boxes, so that saves us a good bit of time. We do still get the calls into the attics and the basements on campus and have to clear out a good bit of junk in those cases. We do a lot of this processing initially, this level, because all of our major manuscript collections are stored off-site. And we get them, we do all of this, we barcode them, and we ship them out to the annex. So we need to have that initial hands on the collection and some processing to figure out what's in there and make sure everything is as accurate as we can make it, and also to address any concerns we have about the collection. Now, full processing. We have made some changes in what we consider full processing. When I first came to the archives, the first 50 years of the president's records had been in very bad storage conditions for many, many decades. They were very brittle, and they needed a lot of work. And so we did do the full processing. There were a lot of rusty paper clips, a lot of rusty staples that were damaging the materials. And for several years, there were a lot of rusty straight pins that were being used instead of staples. So those all were removed. They were all refoldered, all reboxed. After that period, we will refolder if the folder is damaged, if it's too full. We don't generally do the full collection refoldering anymore. There are have been some recent exceptions to that. But generally, that is not something that we do in full processing anymore. Staples and paper clips stay in now. We do take out copies. We had one president, the one who had the scandal, who had 12 copies of every report he had in his records. I got rid of about 6 or 7 cartons per academic year for his materials. It really saved us a lot of space. It got rid of a lot of junk, and he kept every single article on the university that was ever published anywhere in the world clipped in the in his clippings files, and that got rid of a lot of things too. So we will make adjustments according to the administrator's habits. In that case, sometimes you will have a president or other administrator who keeps a lot of copies, who hardly has anything, who just has his own idiosyncrasies that result in the generation of a lot of paper, extra paper. And so we will make adjustments depending on what we find when we do that initial processing, if there are a lot of things in there that we think need to be weeded out and will save us a lot of space. I'll be glad to provide some examples later during the question section if you want to hear some. We do remove thermofax. We had a collection that was absolutely just reeked of it. And my graduate assistant who worked on it, I think, still hates me because of that. So that is something that we will look for when we process it. The ultimate goal is to have a folder-level description of those records. They are open at the minimal processing level. Because we do have a lag time and we do want them to be open and available for research, but ultimately they will have that level of detail, which we find very helpful to do that, as much of that as the front end as possible. Those decisions were made primarily because of staff levels and location. I am the staff of the University Archives. I have one part-time graduate assistant, and I occasionally have some unpaid staff in interns and in students from the library and public history programs that do processing projects. Location. Originally, all of our collections were in a warehouse near campus, and when someone requested something, I had to drive from our historic library on the main campus in my personal vehicle down to the warehouse, pull all the materials, carry them back up, and take them all back again. So it was much better for me to do the level of processing that minimized the number of trips I had to make and the number of materials I had to squeeze into my car to come back and forth, because we didn't have the capacity to have once our staff moved into this historic, into the South Carolinian Library, we just couldn't, it was too hard to go back and forth. Now we have this wonderful remote annex, and they have a staff, and they make the deliveries for me, and it's fabulous. But we're in a historic building, and we share the reading room with the manuscripts division. There's one long table with 12 chairs. There have been times where between my researchers and their researchers, the room has been ringed with boxes. So it's very important for us, to put that effort into the full processing eventually so that we can minimize the number of materials that the researcher needs. We only have 2 deliveries a day, so if they call back 10 boxes and it's not the ones they need, then they have to wait until 3 o'clock in the afternoon to get the next shipment. So logistically, having that detailed finding aid is very important, and it makes it a lot easier not only on our researchers, but also on me and my assistant. We also get those wonderful phone calls at 4 o'clock in the afternoon from the president's office, the Board of Trustees, the provost. And so if I can pinpoint what folder I need to call back from the annex and have there at 8:30 the next morning, that saves me a lot of work. And we get those calls quite frequently. And our current president has actually done some research in the archives. So I was really happy to have him in there. So those are our logistics. That's why, even though we start out with the minimal processing to get control of materials, to get them open and available for research, we still move toward that ultimate goal of having that detailed finding aid so that it really enables us to ease up on the amount of retrieval, of hunting, and better able to serve our researchers and also better able to serve our administrators as well. We have had a good bit of success in working with the secretaries in those administrative offices in changing the way they file certain types of materials. There's one particular series that always composed, filled up two or three boxes per year, and we only kept about six or seven reports out of those two or three boxes. And we met with them, and it dealt with an education organization in South Carolina that every time another college or university would send a proposal to start a new program, to change a program, to end one, every other college and university in the state got a copy of that proposal. And we only need to keep the ones that relate to the University of South Carolina. So now the secretaries only file the USC items, and they don't keep all those other copies that come in from that agency. And that saves us a lot of processing as well, and it reduces the number of materials in that particular year. Another thing, we do keep some materials at that minimal level of processing. We're bringing in about 300 cartons right now that will not go beyond that inventory, and that's the nature of the materials, and that's the fact that they're really just ever going to need internal use and very rarely be used. So those kinds of materials, we do occasionally make that decision that they just will have this the bare minimum of processing just to make them available, and a few things will be at the other end of the spectrum, very intensely processed, item-level description, but that's rare also. Smaller collections are usually not fully processed unless I have a student to do it, and they make really great processing projects for our library and public history students as well. We do rely heavily a lot on our graduate assistants to do processing as well as reference and exhibit work and that kind of thing as well. So, but again, one of the most successful things we've had has been working with the staff members of the offices in changing the way they understand the records and look at the records and realize what we need to do for certain particular record series, and that's reduced the amount of materials coming in and reduced the amount of our work on that as well. That doesn't work well with people that have a lot of turnover in their offices, though. It really works the best with long-term secretaries and administrative assistants. And we have about 25% of our collection is unprocessed and closed at this time.
Okay, thank you. I think we'd like to open it up for questions now or comments, and I would ask that you talk really loud, and then I'll repeat the question and turn it over to the panel if that works for you. Questions? I would also suggest if you have comments or that you'd like to share about things that you're doing in your institution, we may ask you to come up here and grab a mic, but that would be very welcome. Yeah, please go ahead. I'm sorry, what is the approximate volume of material that you accession each year?
It depends. This past year, we've had several hundred linear feet come in, and then there are some years when it's a dribble. So We do have an opportunity, obviously, to decide how much or what collections get the real minimal processing and what gets more detail when we're not scrambling to get all those other things done.
I think the Smithsonian Institutional Archives is one of the few places that measures in cubic feet as opposed to linear feet, but you know, I think believe they're roughly equivalent. We always get at least 400 or 500 cubic feet a year of new accessions. Average is probably closer to about 1,000, and I believe it was 2 years ago we had 2,300 cubic feet in a single year.
We receive about 1,500 linear feet at the low end, and at the high end it's 2,000 or above.
It depends with us as well. We know that we're going to have 200 to 300 cubic feet of materials from certain offices on campus, and this year I'd add another 500, an extra 500 cubic feet because we're working on cleaning out some very large materials for Department of Facilities. They have some warehouses that we're working on. So, but you know, 300 to 400 to 500 cubic feet per year.
While you're thinking about questions, let me just make a couple of comments and maybe suggest some themes that could be pursued here. One of the things I wanted to pick up on was Elizabeth's comment about working with staff extensively to, so that before it ever comes to you, it's been reduced and, you know, volume's been reduced and so forth. I work in congressional papers, and this is something that we're emphasizing increasingly. And it also hooks into the whole field of records management, which is something, particularly with electronic records, that everyone is thinking about more and more and more. I think it's something that might be extrapolated to other situations as well, and I'm thinking in particular of it. I'm housed in the Indiana University Archives, so I eavesdrop a lot, and in fact had occasion to talk with someone who wants to give his personal papers to the Indiana University Archives, and he was very interested in how those should be prepared. I mean, he wants his legacy to live on, and he was interested in how those should be prepared. This is going to be kind of a long-range project, as he's facing some predictable health decline, and so he's very engaged in this. This is not always what you get. I mean, sometimes it's the faculty member just dumping the office on you. I mean, I realize that. But this is a situation where one could work with the donor, talk about how those might be arranged, even possibly getting him to get an assistant to come up with an inventory, a folder list. I mean, what a dream. It comes in with a folder list. You've got minimal processing. It's all, you know, paper from the last 20 years or something. Is wonderful stuff. So that's one theme to think about. And then the other one is, of course, how much you can get done in the actual act of accessioning. I know with congressional papers, I'll just share with you one instance. The first congressional collection I did was a partial collection, 341 cartons out of a possible 3,500. I didn't know what I was getting. Some of the boxes were labeled. It turned out some of those labels were used boxes that had been reused, so I really couldn't depend on that. And I decided the only thing to do, rather than trying to make sense working from box to box, was just open the whole darn thing up and just sit down at the computer and do a folder list. And I did one box per sheet. I took them home, spread them out on the living room floor, and all of a sudden the whole thing coalesced. That box over there, box 323, actually came after 176, which came after 65. I mean, they were labeled in the shipping department, right? The numbered labels had nothing to do with anything. But I was able to put it together that way, saved me enormous amounts of time, of course, because suddenly I could get my head wrapped around the collection. So when I came to face another collection that is about 800 cartons, I realized that I couldn't come up with a work plan or anything else until I did a full folder inventory. Fortunately, about 60% of that had been done to some degree before. It was the smartest move I ever made. I mean, it took me weeks, but I know what the collection looks like. I also know that about between 200 and 300 of those boxes have folders for multiple series because they were repacked and the whole thing's a mess, but at least I can see what the mess is, yeah, and then begin to work with it. So I would, you know, I would just reinforce that comment about trying to put the basic, some processing into your accessioning process. So you always, if you have nothing else, if you never get anything else, you've got that inventory, that folder inventory. So other questions, comments? Yeah. Okay, the question is whether any of the panelists could share an experience where there's been external pressure, whether from a university administration or something, to process a collection on a deadline, yeah, for an anniversary or some kind of special event. Is that an accurate report? Okay.
At the Smithsonian, that's not something we've run into very often. The collections that are most sought after for historical events most of the time are the earlier collections and the collections that were that a lot of care was put into to begin with. So they tend to be the collections that, you know, were already fully processed in the true sense of the word and not the in label only.
We're often challenged to process collections on a timeline. A lot of times it's because of donor expectations. Another big hidden collections or MPLP project we did was the archive of R.R. Donnelly & Sons Company, who gifted us their corporate archive, and then the expectation was that we would process it very quickly for, you know, with no support on their part. So. I also worked, just recently finished another donor-funded project with a local community organization where they had very specific ideas about how they wanted their collection to look and the level of processing they thought was appropriate. And basically we told them they could have what they wanted if they would fund it. So we made... You know, using my own judgment, I worked with them to make decisions that were appropriate for the collection, but it was also one with a very tight deadline and very defined expectations about what the end product would be.
With the institutional records, there's typically a little more foot dragging as opposed to eagerness to get certain things open. But from the other units in the South Carolina Library, you have similar situations with the donors wanting something processed and available, and typically you will ask for assistance in getting something processed more quickly. Usually when we get something urgent, it's for some meeting, it's for some great anniversary, and that is to make sure that we have information on how to use the collections out there. Like with our bicentennial in 2001, we generated a lot of heavy use of the materials. We had some internal pressure to get a particular collection, the one with all the thermofacts, done because of a faculty member's interest in researching the university's use of urban renewal into a predominantly African-American neighborhood. Many people don't realize, you know, there's the basketball arena there. There's nothing ever there before. But they were researching that materials, and it was a very difficult to collection to use, not in great shape. And so we actually closed it for a semester and got it processed and open, and it has gotten a tremendous amount of use. It's now our second most heavily used collection. So that's more of an internal evaluation of, gosh, you know, there's a lot of interest in this particular material, and we really need to get it into a better described so that it can be used more more efficiently.
Are we addressing what was behind your question? Yeah. Oh, I see. So under a timeline constraint, you're wondering whether minimal processing would be chosen or whether it would be a combination or how those decisions would be made. Anything further to add to that?
Well, in the manuscripts division, they do have a much larger backlog of full processing, and their goal is to use the full processing. However, for the most part, the collections are not closed. They may not be fully cataloged or described, but in the reference interviews, you can access the materials. So they're not really closed. They're just not fully described. If there is something coming up, then they will put more pressure into to try to feature those kinds of materials. But a lot of it is tied into a donor of a material or some other kind of special event to have something at least described and out there and bring the attention to it.
Okay. Way in the back? You're going to have to really project. Okay, let me see if I can reproduce this. In a situation where you're not going to the folder level, where minimal processing is not considered to the folder level, and where you would have thousands of boxes, some of them without even having folders in them anyway, how do you proceed? Do you pick one or two items in order to get an idea of the contents of the box, or what exactly do you do? Is that close to what you asked? Okay, good.
And I think your example is great because it really shows how subjective and institution-specific any definition of minimum-level processing will be. And I'll go back to my example of the Donnelly Corporate Archive. There are several dozen boxes where the only description that we have for them is unidentified film reels. So I don't really have any more to say about those boxes until we can reformat the films, and that's not on the horizon right now. So as far as sort of having to pick through the item-by-item boxes, we're lucky in that a lot of that sort of basic level of processing will be handled at the accession stage. So I'm really building on the work that our accession staff have done and adding additional description that will be at that sort of baseline box level or sometimes file level inventory.
I think your question also points the way toward another distinction, and that is that within collections, there can be very different groupings. I mean, if we want to talk about series, we can do that, but of course, before you even have series, you've got a chunk of this, a chunk of that, something might be very conducive to quick minimal processing, providing good access, those boxes of loose papers. I mean, I've had plenty of those too, you know, are going to require a little something that would be a little bit different. And that for me was a real discovery. When I'm working with congressional papers, I realized that there are some things. I mean, I said I did a folder level inventory. Okay, I confess, I cheated. Press releases from this year to that year. There are four boxes of them. I'm not going through there on folder level inventory. They had item level description of the press releases. Well, I'll deal with that later. Okay? So, I mean, I was lying, I guess, to say I did complete folder level inventory. But clearly within a collection, there you might have things that are obviously just chronological, or correspondence is obviously alphabetical, you know, as opposed to something where you're really going to have to devote a little bit more time to gaining access without going completely overboard. So that distinction is one I think we need to, or that freedom I think is one we need to hang on to for ourselves. To, yeah, go ahead. Oh, sorry. Hang on.
I'm mostly dealing with manuscript collections, and it does sound like most of your questions are about archival collections. But my colleague and I, as part of this grant, we had a collection of at least 20 boxes that were called the Town of Stonington Records. That was it. Every single piece of paper in those boxes were folded three times and tied together and put in the boxes, and we could have 1842 over here, and right next to it would be 1920. All right, so there was absolutely no logic to it at all. We recruited some very nice staff people who came and volunteered time, and we actually did unfold absolutely everything. But we only organized things to the year level, because there was no way we were going to be able to get this thing cataloged and get our other 899 collections cataloged by going through it item by item. But by unfolding it, we at least got a sense of what kinds of records were inside. And that's something that we have done consistently, is at least if stuff is all folded up, we're unfolding it enough to get an idea of what we have so that we can write our description. May not always be so easy to find, but at least now we've got the information out there.
At the Smithsonian, most of our collections are less than 20 boxes. We just have a lot of collections. So we're not dealing on the same scale as you might be in terms of any given accessioning project. But we have found that sometimes when you get in a box of loose paper, sometimes it's actually easier and faster to do that item level foldering and listing than it is to try and sort through the documents and decide which ones should go together into the same folder. And so sometimes those boxes that come in the worst shape actually wind up with the best description because that's actually the easiest way of doing it. On the opposite end, I've had collections of, a box or two in the middle of a collection of budget records that, one page will be from, 1999, and the next page will be 1992, and there's absolutely no order, and there's, thousands of sheets of paper. I'm not going to sort through every single one. And in those cases, we at least get the date range, and we just put it in folders, and then our finding aid says, box 10, budget records, 1992 to 1999, 25 folders. It's not ideal, but it at least allows the researcher to say, okay, that's the box I need, and then they'll have to do the sorting.
We don't get that often, but occasionally, and it's usually one of the situations where we have to go into the basement or the attic to pull materials out, and we will flip through each item to check it. And part of that, again, is the eye toward the privacy concerns during a certain period of the university administration. They would write the student's social security numbers were their ID numbers. And so any correspondence with the student has that social security number written down there, and often their date of birth as well. And it could be simply a letter to the president saying, gee, thank you, I really enjoyed my time here at the university. There's the social security number. So we will go through a box like that where they're not folded, and we do occasionally get them. Sometimes it's when someone's vacating an office and dumps the materials in. We do redact the social security numbers, which is a good bit of work. Fortunately, it's slacking off now that they realize it's not a good idea to put the numbers on there. But and the reason for that is that identity theft is a crime of opportunity for the most part, and my feeling is that if we don't really trust our patrons not to steal our materials, then we can't really trust them not to jot down a social security number, since it is such a crime of opportunity. Maybe that's the cynical cop's wife talking, but that is something that I feel very strongly about. And past dealings with our university legal department, I really don't have much confidence in being defended very well should someone sue over that. So, but we do have to. There was a case where we had about 20 cartons of materials that were in an attic. Those were the 20 we kept and had to go through, and they were not folded, not organized, dumped in the boxes. We got rid of 150 from the attic based on the retention schedule. So that is something that we do have to do occasionally, and I feel like it is worth at least doing an initial sort through to see what's in there, if there's something alarming or concerning.
Okay, where was that question in the bag? Was it you? Yeah, go ahead. Okay, so the question is, could you talk about AV media, electronic, and how you're proposing to process those? Is that it? Okay.
I'll go first because I'll be the shortest. I don't know. I really don't know. We've had a very difficult time getting support from the university administration to take that seriously. The libraries just purchased Digital Commons to try to get faculty materials, but also electronic publications in there. And that is a tremendous source of concern that we have, and we've really been struggling with it and have no solution at this point.
We actually have a lot of audiovisual materials. The Smithsonian once had a film, video, and radio production unit, and they closed down in 2002, about 9 months after I started, and so I was the new person in and the one who had the most time, so I've gotten to deal with that. I'm still dealing with that, all the materials that they had just accumulated over time. We actually have the equipment to rewind all the film and put it onto cores, which is incredibly time-consuming, but for preservation purposes is really worth it. Videos, we're just dealing with the record tabs and those sorts of things. Audio, there's not a lot we're doing with it. Open reel, we're taping down the ends and those sorts of things. So we are doing more initial preservation work on those materials, and then reformatting is usually on it either by grant or by researcher request in the future. Those things we are doing an item level description for, which is really essential to determining what we even have when a researcher says, "I'm looking for such and such a production." If we have it in a format that we can reformat on site, if it's something we need to send out, what sort of cost are we talking about in terms of getting it reproduced? And we need to know things like, do we have the master? if we don't have the master, then we have to be able to identify what we can use in place of the master. So that item level description is actually really important. In terms of electronic records, we have an electronic records program. We have two IT archivists. We're doing a pretty decent job of capturing electronic records, preserving electronic records. We're still working out how we want to do descriptive work on electronic records. Generally, I'd say the majority of our accessions with electronic records, they're a CD or floppy disk thrown into a folder or loose into a box, and we'll just, if it's in a folder with a title, we'll put the folder title down, a parentheses, includes electronic records. If it's a fully electronic collection, we're really just doing collection level description at this point, because we haven't really figured out the best way of doing a lower level of description. If we had in theory, if we had a really nicely a really nice folder structure for the records coming in that the office created, which is almost never the case, we could probably take that folder structure and then turn it into a finding aid. But we haven't actually had any examples of that yet.
Anyone else?
Yeah.
Okay, the question is, could each of the panelists reiterate the number of cubic feet or whatever measure you're using processed by per hour, and what kind of rate might be used for grant proposals? Is that fair, Jackie? Okay.
You know, I don't remember what I put down in my grant proposal.
You better not say anything.
I know. Dan is right over there. I know. I'm in deep trouble now. But for the most recent grant that we got, I know we've been focusing a lot on account books, and we can get 6 account books done within the course of a day, and that's doing the initial research as to who the writer or the creator was, and then getting all the life dates and that sort of thing, and creating the record. For the larger manuscript collections, maybe a cubic foot a day.
We have statistics for the collections that we already had that we were then preparing to send off-site, and those were about an hour per cubic foot. That's an average for 10,000 cubic feet, ranging from things that really just needed, some spacers and, a couple of new folders to collections that had thousands and thousands of slides that needed to be sleeved and lots of loose paper and that sort of thing. So it's probably a fairly good average. But if you were, in terms of applying for a grant, I think you'd really need to look at the material you have and the state it's in. Even though you're trying to reach the same level, some collections are going to need a lot more work to get to a certain level than other collections will. I think some collections will require a larger number of hours per cubic foot than other collections.
I'm pretty much on the same page as Jennifer. If I'm planning out a project, I use 0.5 linear feet would be, kind of the lowest we can achieve, and that would be a collection that doesn't need refoldering and might even already have a basic inventory in Word that we can sort of repurpose for a finding aid. And then I've worked on projects that I think took as much as 4 or 5 hours per linear foot, and that was really something where we had donor interest or outside funding of some kind. If I think it's going to take more than that, I don't really think it's a good project for the program that I lead. So we try to leave that out of the picture entirely. If it's going to take us more than that, it just doesn't fit into what my benchmarks are. I would be really reluctant to try to throw out, an average for any collection, because I think it's so case by case. And when I am planning work, I'm sort of looking to hit somewhere between that 0.5 linear feet and somewhere around 4 or 5 per hour.
Well, we don't have a standard either. It really depends on at what point the condition of the collection and who's processing it. I'm a lot faster than my graduate assistants are, just because I've gone through so many of these series. I recognize so much and know a lot of the people that it's I can make much quicker decisions. So you're probably... something like the president's records, you could do a cubic foot, 1 or 2 cubic feet in a day, and that's that would be a folder level description, kind of full processing. The graduate assistant would take a bit longer until they really get going on something that usually is very well organized like that. And then obviously something like the VP of operations or some of the provost records, just the things from the attic. Took much longer. The attic collection was 20 cartons, 20 feet. It took a student, it was a 40-hour processing project. So they did a great job on that.
I was just playing back what I said in my head, and I think I flipped my ratios around halfway through. I would 0.5 hours per linear foot at the low end, so 30 minutes per linear foot at the low end, and then up to 4 hours per linear foot. Sorry about that.
Yeah, Jackie, when I was trying to put together a grant proposal to NHPRC, which was successful, for which I will be eternally grateful, I promise, Dan, eternally grateful, I actually started timing myself, just to try. I thought, well, let's figure it out, and then realized I would have students working with me, which would slow it down a little bit, just as I was building the work plans and so forth. So that's one approach. Yeah. Any other questions?
I just wanted to add something to that. We've actually found that sometimes the interns can process things faster than we can, because the interns are sitting at a desk just processing, every minute of the day, more or less, whereas the rest of the staff, they might get through half a box, and then if an email comes up that they have to answer, and then someone walks into their door, and a conversation happens, and then they have to run off to a meeting, and so it actually does depend on who's doing the processing and if they have any other responsibilities.
Yeah. Good point, yeah. Okay, the question is, are any of you using Archivist Toolkit, and does that help or hinder with your processing?
We had initially, when we sent the grant in, we said we were going to use Archivist Toolkit, but we got feedback from NHPRC, and they said, well, look, you've got an access database for your accessioning, and you're creating MARC records. You've already got the software. Why reinvent the wheel? And so we pulled back very, very quickly because the learning curve, I thought, would be too much and slow us down significantly. So we just kept with our same procedure.
We're also using a collection management system that was developed in-house, and we've been refining and adding to meet our needs over the years.
Any other responses, Maya?
We don't use Archivist Toolkit. We use a variety of internal tools that we've developed over time. We use the XML server MARC logic for our finding aids. And one thing I love about using our internal tools is that we've been very flexible in developing them over time. So as our standards have developed and our needs change, we've been able to customize the tools that we're using very easily.
We don't use Toolkit.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions? Yes. In your opinion, what is the biggest drawback to MPLP?
I don't have as much time to linger over really cool parts of collections. When I was processing the Donnelly Archive and really only had a few weeks to work on the records of their graphic conservation department, for example, it was, you know, personally I was bummed out, but, you know, it was available faster for others.
Things will show up in surprising places, and one particular example was a faculty member that was heavily involved in the plans for integration of the University of South Carolina, and some additional correspondence related to that showed up in a very odd folder in the department, in the School of Arts and Sciences, and had we not gone to that level, we would not have found that. And the other thing, as I said, for us is just the volume of materials and our very tight space to do reference. Our researchers tend to be very, very happy when they know the precise folder that they need from the particular year, and they just need to get that one box as opposed to 10 or 20.
I'm always worried about missing that gem that might be hidden somewhere in a folder because we're going through so quickly. A lot of our collections are quite old, and we've got a lot of founding father-type collections, and I'm sure there's some stuff in there that, because we're going through so quickly, we're not picking up. But we, in the back of our mind, I think we're always thinking that the researcher is going to eventually come who's going to know this collection better than we are and is going to say, hey, did you know that this was in here? And then we'll be able to amend whatever sort of discovery tool we have to reflect that.
I agree with everything that everyone has said. In addition, some things that can be frustrating is if we're just using the divisions and the folders that someone who's sent us personal papers in particular has used, a lot of times it'll be, you know, a folder of correspondence just marked H, and then, or sometimes it'll be, you know, SA to SE, and you don't really know who the correspondents are in those folders, but at the same time, it would just be way too much time for us to go through 20 boxes of that and pull out each individual correspondent into its own folder, and so it's the same case. We have to rely on the researchers to just assume that something might be there and find it.
I think, go ahead. Probably one more here, yeah. As you've done more MPLP, minimal processing, has that increased the quality of your accessioning process? I'm confusing terms here. Has that increased the quality of your accessioning? Is that the question? Yeah. Okay, so that increased the amount of detail you put into accessioning as opposed to the amount of detail you would put into processing.
I don't know that it always makes a difference, but I think sometimes when you're doing the minimal processing at accessioning versus doing just a quick inventory at accessioning and then then processing it later, I think it helps you create a better collection level description. We do access terms and all of that at the time of accessioning, and always have. We're more likely to miss a major part of the collection in the collection level description, or miss a major access term if we wait to do that processing until later on.
Our accessioning procedures are really a form of really basic processing where a folder level list is created, or at least some kind of basic box level kind of list of terms. I would say that actually in some cases it's been that we do less work in accessioning now, particularly when our accessions manager can work with me to identify collections that would be really good candidates to just get processed right away and shoot straight from accessions to going through me to delegate to a student to maybe touch something up and then do the EAD finding aid and call it done. But that said, we've always, not always, but since the early 1980s, done a very, I think, high quality job of accessioning. So it definitely hasn't negatively impacted that relationship between accession staff and processing staff, or put more of a burden on them.
I think we've seen improvement in the amount of work we do initially when we receive the collections than the way they were received before, where they were transferred and stored at the warehouse and then worked on as we got to them. But now we have a lot of hands-on, a lot of handling of the materials when they come in, and then working with the staff has really helped as well, because we get far more accurate information from them now when the materials come in. And it just really has been very beneficial that way, and it gives us better handling of what's in the collection even before we get to that full processing stage.
One thing we have done as a result of my going back through some of the early accession records is make sure that there's a more complete description. My favorite one was miscellaneous manuscripts of minimal information or value. You know, how many, you know, who wrote it, whatever. So we're certainly doing that. A lot more description of the collection itself. And we have to do that also now because we are passing everything past a collection steering committee. And they don't necessarily see the material, but we have to make a good argument as to why it should be added or not added to the collection. So we're examining things a lot more carefully.
Good. Let me just add one little note with regard to unexpected things or problems, drawbacks, and so forth. It seems to me that one of the things that we need to remember is that there are a lot of archivists with a lot of experience looking at a lot of kinds of collections, and probably most of you are those archivists. One of the concerns that has been expressed about MPLP was that it might be applied wholesale by archivists coming into the field, might appear to be the only way to do things. And I think it's important to emphasize what you know and recognize what you know about what can be expected in a certain kind of document, a certain kind of file, a certain kind of series, and so forth, that might then play into their ability to exercise good archival judgment. So just a last thought. Thank you all so much for coming.